Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The man's breath came in great shuddering gasps. He'd been running for what seemed like hours. His lungs burned with the effort. Pain and weakness racked his legs. Blood from a cut on his cheekbones seeped out and matted into his thick beard, mixing with the copious sweat that rolled down his forehead underneath his helmet. Dents and scratches, all of them fresh, marred the surface of the steel. Better a dented helmet than a dented head, the man thought. He marveled that the Barbute had somehow stayed atop his head over the miles of fleeing for his life up and down the gentle slopes of Nottinghamshire. This stand of woods, fine English oak in the full bloom of late spring, offered some respite. June 16, 1487 had not been the best day of this man's life. His name was Hans, and Nottinghamshire was a long, long way from home. He felt a pang of longing for Augsburg, for the smell of leather and the shoemaker's shop where he'd grown up, and he regretted every decision along the way that had brought him to the life of a mercenary. This hadn't been his first battle. Hans had the scars to prove it, but if his luck continued the way it had, the fight at Stoke Field would definitely be his last. Sheltering in the shade of the oaks, Hans stopped for a moment to take stock. His breeches and boots were soaking wet from his dash across a ford in the River Trent a little ways back. He still had his breastplate and helmet. His arquebus, his brand new matchlock handgun, was long gone, but his short sword and dagger remained in their scabbards on his belt. His meager possessions were all lost back at the abandoned camp, though he had a few precious gold coins sewn into the lining of his shirt. A sharp pain stabbed at his right arm, a deep gash where one of the innumerable English arrows that darkened the skies of Nottinghamshire had found a home in his flesh. Hans tore a couple of strips of woolen cloth from his shirt. One of them he used to mop up the blood pouring from the wound, and the second he wrapped around the gash in a makeshift bandage. Blood soaked through the cloth in a moment, and then slowed. The fact that he'd escaped the slaughter with a cut on his cheek and a flesh wound in his arm made him far luckier than most of the 2,000 other German and Swiss mercenaries he had been with that day. A piercing scream cut through the quiet of the oaks. Only a few hundred yards back the way he'd come, Hans thought. The English had caught up with one of his erstwhile comrades. He knew there was nothing he could do for the man now. Gangs of longbowmen and men-at-arms were hunting down every survivor who had come to this place. German, Swiss, Irish, and English, with the Earl of Lincoln in his doomed attempt to take the crown of England. Hans asked himself, how had he ended up here, in the shade of a foreign wood, hiding from enemies whose language he didn't speak, in the aftermath of a battle whose causes he didn't understand? Driven by the thought of the scream and what had caused it, Hans pushed himself further into the shrubs and undergrowth. There was an overturned log, dense with lichen and moss, and Hans squirmed into a hollow underneath. He heard hoofbeats get louder and louder, intruding on the quiet of his sanctuary. Voices broke the silence of the wood, drowning out the whisper of the breeze through the branches. A silent prayer escaped his lips. "Please, God," Hans thought, "let them pass me by." Horses whinnied. Metal banged against metal, armor and weapons clanging together. Footsteps thudded on the floor of the wood. Voices called out, laughing. Hans couldn't understand the English words, but he felt the emotion, the fierce elation that came after surviving a life or death struggle. Underneath the scent of sweat, urine, and ordure, Hans could smell just a hint of blood, overpowering even the damp musk of the wood. The footsteps and voices came closer and closer to the overturned log. Hans shrank down into his hiding spot and prayed once more. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Wars of the Roses were one of the defining conflicts of the late Middle Ages, an on-and-off series of civil wars that racked England between 1455 and 1485. The entire political order of what had only recently been Europe's most stable and centralized kingdom collapsed in slow motion. Royal authority, personified in the inert, useless figure of King Henry VI, fell apart as others struggled to exercise power for a king who couldn't do it himself. It was only a matter of time before the simmering crisis degenerated into bouts of open and incredibly destructive warfare. Some of the bloodiest battles of the Middle Ages stained the English countryside red. Dynasties rose and fell, first the Lancastrians and then the Yorkists, until the unlikely figure of Henry Tudor, an exile with the most tenuous possible claim to the throne, emerged victorious at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. The Wars of the Roses have stayed in the popular imagination for centuries. The name is cool and memorable, which helps, but this turbulent time also featured some of the most compelling characters of the whole medieval period. The talented 18-year-old giant who became King Edward IV, eventually undone by his incredible appetites for food, drink, and sex. His ally and then enemy, the treacherous Earl of Warwick, the kingmaker who stood behind Edward's rise and then turned on him. Edward's brother, the usurper Richard III, who almost certainly had his brother's sons murdered in his bid to claim the throne. Elizabeth Woodville, Edward's queen, who rose from the lower ranks of the nobility to place her large extended family at the heights of power. Margaret Beaufort, Henry Tudor's mother, who worked tirelessly to put her son on the throne. And lastly, Henry Tudor himself, a virtual stranger to England who seized his moment to take the crown and then defended it with icy ruthlessness for the next quarter century. This is fertile ground for both history and fiction, full of twists and turns and backstabbing and betrayal and blood and death. It's easy to see why first Shakespeare and then generations of novelists, filmmakers, and historians have made it the home to some amazing works, and even how it inspired George R.R. Martin to serve as the basis for Game of Thrones. It's full of great stories and charismatic personalities, and the whole thing has an appealing narrative arc. Fall, rise, fall, and rise. The third act's villain, Richard III, dies on the battlefield of Bosworth, replaced by the underdog protagonist Henry Tudor. Boom, there's your story. But Bosworth wasn't the end. Henry Tudor's hold on the English throne was insecure throughout his reign, but especially at the beginning. His claim was weak, even by the standards prevailing after 30 years of upheaval. There were plenty of usurpations within living memory. What was one more? A new contender with a battlefield victory could easily take Henry's place. The Tudors weren't destined to become one of England's most famous dynasties. In 1487, an army showed up on the rocky, craggy coast of northwestern England. At its head was the Earl of Lincoln, a young man named John de la Pole. The Earl of Lincoln was the nephew of the dead Richard III, and he had been his uncle's designated successor as king. This was at least as good a claim as Henry VII had possessed in the lead-up to Bosworth. Why not give it a try? The Earl's army included only a few Englishmen, but thousands of Irish mercenaries and 2,000 disciplined, professional Swiss and Germans hired on the continent. Among them was our friend Hans. Hans is a composite character, not a real person, but he's going to help us understand the complicated world of the later 15th century. As with Margaret the Brewer, this is maybe a little closer to historical fiction than our usual fare here, but we're going to organically follow the themes and processes of the age by following Hans. He didn't show up at Stokefield by accident. Deep currents pulled the son of an Augsburg shoemaker to an English battlefield in the summer of 1487. Everything from shifts in the practice of warfare to international finance to the interconnected Europe-wide politics of the day. Today, we're going to follow Hans on his long journey and try to wrap our heads around all of this. We've been to Augsburg before on Tides, several times. It was the home of Jakob Fugger and the Fugger family, a wealthy and thriving center of trade, cloth manufacturing, and eventually finance. Here, along a narrow, bustling street in a city of perhaps 15,000 people, our friend Hans was born in January of 1453. His father, Paul, was a shoemaker, an artisan on the middling part of the socioeconomic spectrum. Not rich like the wealthy merchants and weavers and goldsmiths who dominated Augsburg's urban elite, but not poor either. The shoemakers, Schuster, had a guild, which meant that they were represented in Augsburg's city government. They had a voice, even if it was often drowned out by those with much greater wealth and influence. Most of all, the shoemakers had an identity, rules, regulations, and a sense of what it meant to belong in the complex patchwork of late medieval urban society. Every guild had its hall, its special festivals, its processions, and its special livery, and this gave them a real place in Augsburg. To belong to a guild was to matter, and Paul the Shoemaker, as humble as he was, mattered. Shoemakers were both producers and retailers, dealing directly with customers and suppliers of raw materials. A master shoemaker, like Paul, had a shop and apprentices, but he also had a market stall where he sold finished products. This made shoemakers a bit unusual in the world of late medieval artisans. Usually, there was a strong divide between the retail and production aspects of crafting. Our friend Margaret the Brewer, for example, didn't deal much with the people who were actually drinking her ale and beer. The ale sellers or alewives, a much lower status occupation in London, did that. Weavers almost never had contact with the final users of their cloth, since it went to clothiers or tailors for finishing or to merchants for long-distance resale first. Even shoemakers didn't deal with everything related to shoes. For example, cobblers repaired shoes but didn't make them, and they could only work with secondhand leather. No respectable member of the Shoesters, the Shoemakers Guild, wanted to be confused for a mere cobbler. Those kinds of distinctions were the bread and butter of medieval life. Fine gradations of status and occupation were what made people who they were. Group membership defined the individual, and no group mattered more to individual identity than a guild. As little Hans grew up, this stuff was everywhere around him. 1453, the year of Hans's birth, was an eventful one. It's a cliche to say that these were changing times, but 1453 really was a watershed year on a number of different fronts. An enormous Ottoman army finally succeeded in taking the ancient city of Constantinople, battering down its walls with cannon and ending the Byzantine Empire once and for all. This sent shocks throughout Christendom, and the Ottoman dynasty announced themselves as the great new power of the century. Some 240 miles away from Augsburg in the city of Mainz, a goldsmith named Johannes Gutenberg was several years into a new venture, producing books with a new technique that used movable metal type and a press. These things bore only a little on the newborn shoemaker's son. But far away in southwestern France, a series of events took place that shaped Hans's future in ways he and his parents couldn't begin to comprehend. There, on a field in Aquitaine, French cannon demolished an English army in the final battle of the Hundred Years' War. John Talbot, the Earl of Shrewsbury, was one of the toughest, most competent, and most respected soldiers in England. He was known as the English Achilles. His death on the battlefield of Castillon and the destruction of his army emphatically marked the end of an era. The days of Henry V and Agincourt were long past. England wasn't a great power anymore. Its feckless king, Henry VI, and its creaking political system would have to deal with the fallout. This was the equivalent of pouring gasoline on burning coals of discontent and dysfunction. The flames soon erupted into the Wars of the Roses. We spent a lot of time talking about the Wars of the Roses earlier this year, so if you'd like to go deep on their causes, course, and legacy, go ahead and check out those episodes. For now, though, here's a brief refresher. A lot of different things contributed to the Wars of the Roses, from local unrest to the ambitions of powerful lords. But the core issue was royal authority. England had developed a whole governmental system over the course of the Middle Ages. It had a major role for Parliament as a lawmaking and taxing body, and an increasingly professional bureaucracy and legal system. Still, everything revolved around the king and his household. The king was the one who set this machine in motion, who decided on everything from military campaigns to the distribution of lands and lordships to how royal justice would be deployed. The king had to be active. He had to make decisions, even if they were bad ones. But the big issue in England was King Henry VI. He came to the throne as a baby after his father, the great Henry V, died of disease in 1422. Now, obviously, a baby couldn't make decisions, so a series of regents and councils ruled on his behalf until he came of age. The problem was that even when Henry VI was technically old enough to exercise his own authority, the young man was deeply incapable of doing so. So a series of advisors and favorites ruled for him. The first of these was William de la Pole, Duke of Suffolk, who had the misfortune of presiding over the disastrous loss of Normandy to the French in 1449. Suffolk's mismanagement got him exiled, but on his way out of the country, a group of angry sailors captured him, subjected him to a mock trial, and then cut his head off. The Duke of Somerset was the next royal favorite. He forged a close alliance, maybe too close, with Henry's formidable wife, Margaret of Anjou, and the two ruled effectively together for the next couple of years. Somerset's great rival was Richard, the Duke of York, who thought he should be the one exercising royal power for the effectively absent Henry. The personal conflict between Somerset and York lay at the root of the Wars of the Roses, and it exploded into open violence at the city of St. Albans in May of 1455. Somerset fell in the battle, and York was triumphant, at least for the moment. Power seesawed back and forth between the two factions, Yorkist and Lancastrian, for the next several years until war broke out again in 1459. Now, a lot of this was personal. York hated Margaret of Anjou and Somerset, and the feeling was mutual. The first outbreak of violence at St. Albans created deep rivalries and anger that would never go away. But this was also structural. England was a fractious place at every level, from the rivalries of the highest nobility all the way down to the vicious arguments of local notables over estates and inheritance. Royal justice was the solution for this, an impartial arbiter of disputes at every level, but that only worked if it was actually the king providing it. Henry VI couldn't do that, so it was his favorites and allies who did it on his behalf. This created both the appearance and reality of favoritism, of disunity, and it turned the king himself into a pawn of a faction rather than an ultimate authority figure available to all. This was a genuine crisis of royal authority. The king was supposed to be the uniting figure, the leader, and the fount of power that brought together the whole political system. If he could not fulfill that role, it was only a matter of time until everything fell apart. That's exactly what was bound to happen in England. The Battle of St. Albans in 1455 was technically the beginning, and it certainly played a role in making open violence thinkable for the political elite. But it was only a taste of what was coming. Some of the bloodiest battles of the Middle Ages were just around the corner.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
While England's elite was arguing and fighting over everything from raw power to the control of vast lands, with the basically inert Henry VI sitting by, young Hans was growing up in an Augsburg shoemaker's shop. He had been born in 1453, the second son of Peter. His elder brother, also named Peter, was 3 years older. From early on, tragedy marked Hans's life. His mother died when he was just a year old, giving birth to a little girl who likewise didn't survive the ordeal. Hans had no memories of his mother. This was heartbreaking, of course, but it was an everyday sort of tragedy in the pre-modern world. Childbirth is still dangerous today, and it was infinitely more so before the advent of modern medicine. In fact, it was the most common killer of women. Every pregnancy was potentially lethal from beginning to end. If the average woman of the time carried somewhere between 5 and 10 children to term over the course of her childbearing life, around the average, she stood a good chance of dying in the process. The death of his mother marked Hans's life circumstances in profound ways. Peter remarried soon after she died. His second wife was the daughter of a well-off member of the Shoemakers Guild, and marrying her marked a step up for Peter. Her dowry meant additional capital to expand his shop, and connections with his new father-in-law likewise offered the potential for growth. His eldest son stood to inherit, of course, but this left Hans in a bind. Peter and his new wife had several more children. His stepmother wasn't some wicked monster out of a fairy tale, but the second son of her predecessor wasn't her priority. He wasn't his father's priority either. Peter wasn't an especially kind man. He didn't drink to excess often, unlike some of his peers in the hard-drinking society of Augsburg artisans, but when he did, the shoemaker was a terror. Hans suffered more than a few beatings at his father's hands when he came home from the shoemaker's guild hall after a binge, reeking of beer. Little Hans liked to talk back and didn't run for cover the way the rest of the family did, and he took the worst of it. It wasn't surprising that Hans wasn't overly fond of Peter, and the feeling was mutual. Where his elder brother came under his father's wing and spent most of his childhood in the workshop, learning to make expensive shoes for Augsburg's elite with needles, awls, and fine leather, Hans snuck out of the house whenever he could. The boy learned to read and write, a considerable expense Peter never forgave him for, but he refused to become a priest. He learned basic accounting, a necessity for any artisan, but refused to become a clerk for one of Augsburg's thriving merchant operations, like the branches of the Fugger family then rising to prominence. A university education was out of the question, and Hans flatly refused an apprenticeship to another shoemaker, his father's last attempt to put him on a respectable path. As Hans grew into a short, stocky teenager with an already squashed nose and a cauliflower ear, his only real passions were wrestling and brawling. It's not that he was stupid, as his father often unkindly claimed, or that he didn't want to work hard. Well, that was maybe a bit closer to the mark. Hans just hated shoemaking, hated his father, and didn't want to do anything that might please him, even incidentally. Medieval families weren't immune to toxic dynamics, and by the time Hans was 18, in 1471, his father had had enough. He gave Hans a little money, a couple of worn gold gulden and some freshly minted silver coins, and kicked him out of the house for good. Peter never wanted to see him again. Once more, the feeling was mutual. Even for a young man planted firmly in the middle of Augsburg's respectable artisanal classes, violence was a common part of young Hans's life. It wasn't just his father delivering drunken beatings. Young men like Hans had a touchy sense of honor, and beer flowed freely, even for teenagers. Everybody carried at least a knife, if not a more substantial weapon. This was a recipe for trouble. Stabbings and fights were common in Augsburg's taverns and across late medieval Germany. Martin Luther's father, the perfectly respectable mining operator Hans Luder, was known for bashing local drunks over the head with a stout beer stein in a pinch until the blood ran. Beyond the casual fights between testosterone-filled and beer-fueled young men, local feuds and city politics often spilled over into violence. This was a golden age of robber knights and small-scale warfare in southern Germany. Every city's citizens had a duty to serve as militia in times of trouble, to keep weapons at home, and occasionally to practice with them. Those were just the amateurs. There were, of course, professional soldiers. One of them was a fellow Augsburg shoemaker, a man the 18-year-old Hans knew well, named Martin Schwarz. He was a few years older than Hans and had grown up just a few streets away. His reputation was nasty, even by the relaxed standards Augsburg applied to rowdy younger men, and his skill with an awl and leather paled next to his readiness to fight. Schwarz had learned the art of handling gunpowder handguns and cannon, a sought-after skill in an increasingly war-torn age. When he ran into young Hans in a tavern one night in the spring of 1471, he sensed a bit of a kindred spirit and offered to bring him along on his next campaign. Hans took the money his father had given him and bought a crossbow, a short sword, and a dagger. He was ready to go. There was plenty of work for soldiers as the 1470s dawned, some of it close to Augsburg, some of it further away. In England, the Wars of the Roses were entering a brand new phase. Their real lead violence had exploded a decade before in a series of battles in 1459, 1460, and 1461 that left thousands dead and a new king, the 18-year-old giant Edward IV, on the throne. A few years of peace followed, but once this Pandora's box of civil strife and unrest had been opened, it was really difficult to close it again. Edward's reign was never secure. His greatest ally, the Earl of Warwick, known as the Kingmaker, turned on him, supporting first his brother and then the exiled wife and son of Henry VI in their bids for the English crown. It took three more years of fighting, from 1469 to 1471, for Edward to cement himself on the English throne. Just as young Hans was leaving home, the third major phase of the Wars of the Roses was coming to an end.
all of this was still a very long way away. If Hans had been in the Low Countries, sure, anything that happened in England was a big deal. It was right across the channel, with deep commercial connections that tied the two together. Any instability in England reverberated through that commerce and affected Bruges, Ghent, and Antwerp. Think back to our episode on the Seeley family of wool merchants. They spent much of their time in Calais and Flanders, and information and goods traveled freely. The Rhineland, too, felt these shocks, though less strongly since it was only a short hop from the thriving Rhine corridor to London. Augsburg was a bit further, still connected, but much more loosely. If Hans heard about the fighting in England, it was after the fact. German mercenaries didn't do much in these phases of the Wars of the Roses. There were still a number of possibilities for an aspiring soldier closer to Augsburg, though. The Duke of Burgundy, Charles the Bold, had plenty of ambition and deep pockets. His territories extended from the Low Countries through Luxembourg, skipped over Lorraine, and then included the Imperial County of Burgundy, part of the Holy Roman Empire, and the Duchy of Burgundy, part of the Kingdom of France. Charles's position was complicated. He was a vassal of the King of France, an independent ruler of other territories, and a prince of the Holy Roman Empire. What he really wanted was to weld this disparate collection of territories into a single unit, a kingdom of his own. Just a note, if you'd like to know more about the now mostly forgotten, almost Kingdom of Burgundy, check out the episode we released on the topic earlier this year. By 1471, when Hans entered the pool of military manpower looking for work in this region, the mercenary market, there was plenty of work to go around. There were feuds, small wars, outings against troublesome robber knights, and the occasional larger campaign, most of them driven by Charles the Bold's limitless appetite for new lands and titles. Hans got his start with Schwarz in these smaller wars, learning to use his sword and crossbow as he raided merchant caravans, besieged small castles, and ambushed enemies. Along the way, in these first few years, Hans turned his attention to gunpowder. Crossbowmen were a dime a dozen, but cannoneers and handgunners were more specialized and more highly paid. That was a potentially good career for an aspiring mercenary, and it pointed the way toward one of the future paths of early modern warfare. Gunpowder wasn't exactly new in the early 1470s. It had first appeared on European battlefields more than a century before, but without much real effect until the early decades of the 15th century. Techniques for producing gunpowder improved, giving it more explosive power. So did metal casting, which made cannon better able to handle the more powerful loads of powder without cracking. The high, thin walls of medieval castles and towns stood little chance of repelling a dedicated siege with enough gunpowder artillery. But cannon didn't immediately remake the course of military history. They were expensive to produce, hard to move from place to place, and pricey to operate on extended campaigns. Even when deployed effectively, with enough powder and shot and in sufficient numbers, they couldn't guarantee success on their own. The Ottoman taking of Constantinople in 1453 owed as much or more to logistics, manpower, and sheer bloody-minded will as it did the effectiveness of Sultan Mehmed's enormous train of artillery. Plenty of quote-unquote medieval fortifications held up fine against cannon, often for extended periods of time. All of this was true for cannon and even more for gunpowder handguns. Shoulder stocks, triggers, and the matchlock firing mechanism all took ages to develop. They were just starting to appear by the time our friend Hans took up soldiering, in the form of the arquebus, the first truly viable handheld firearm with a trigger and a matchlock serpentine mechanism. It had a trigger mechanism, unlike its predecessors, which activated a serpentine lock that held a bit of burning slow match. When you pulled the trigger, the match came down onto the touch hole, setting off the gunpowder charge in the barrel, and off the shot went. This was a drastic improvement over having to hold a match with your hands, touch it to a touch hole, point and pray. This was a truly viable weapon. The upshot is this. It would be easy to point to gunpowder as some revolutionary thing, but it wasn't, and definitely not right away. Technological change here is part of a broader story of rising states, state finance, and military culture, not just the lightning-quick impact of a new development. Still, by the early 1470s, gunpowder was a meaningful part of every cutting-edge army in Europe and beyond. No quality siege on anything other than a local scale could progress without cannon. Practically every army had some handgunners. This was the niche into which our friend Hans began to fit himself, adopting the newfangled arquebus early and also spending time as a gunner on larger cannon. His first major campaigns came after a few years of smaller wars. Hans headed north from southern Germany toward the Rhineland, where the Burgundian Duke Charles the Bold's campaigns were heating up after 1473. Charles paid well for good soldiers and had designs on building a professional standing army of mercenaries. He preferred Italians, experienced condottieri, and imported thousands of them. Skilled English longbowmen, many of them veterans of the sharp conflicts of the Wars of the Roses, were other favored employees. Fewer of Charles's mercenaries were Germans, despite the proximity of his lands to the Holy Roman Empire, but there were a few. Hans was among them, and he took service with Charles's substantial artillery train. So did Martin Schwarz, Hans's old Augsburg shoemaking companion. From 1473 to 1476, Hans made his living fighting for Charles the Bold. This was a nasty business. Hans spent months in disgusting trenches around the German city of Neuss in 1474, working his cannon incessantly as the defenders fired back, raided their lines, and generally caused havoc. He saw guns explode, other gunners eviscerated by return fire from the city, and the slaughter of some of Charles's Italian mercenaries when they tried an ill-advised assault on the exterior fortifications. The siege was a terrible failure, the first real defeat of Charles's career, and it left a bad taste in Hans's mouth. Still, as long as Charles was paying, Hans stuck around. Martin Schwarz left, seeking other employment, but Hans would see him again before long. The year after the Siege of Neuss, Charles invaded the Duchy of Lorraine, attempting to link up his northern lands in the Duchy of Luxembourg to his southern lands in Burgundy. The campaign was an immediate success, but Charles carried it on with vicious brutality. Hans saw the hanging of 37 men from a single tree outside the city of Charmey and spent the night sleeping in a tent with the corpses swinging above him. He felt like Charles was heading for trouble, and he was right. Hans fought only one pitched battle for Charles the Bold in the early spring of 1476. The Swiss had entered the war against the Burgundian Duke, and he retaliated by invading their lands and besieging the castle of Grandson. Charles hung the garrison there, too. But a Swiss relief force soon showed up. Charles wanted to give battle, and Hans was among the gunners pointing cannon across the field at the masses of approaching Swiss pikemen. The battle was an utter disaster. Hans, along with the rest of the soldiers in Charles's service, ran from the battlefield, leaving all their cannon behind. He barely escaped with his life and wanted nothing more to do with the Duke of Burgundy. The fact that Charles was completely bankrupt and unable to pay his soldiers' wages effectively made the decision for Hans. Soon after, he slipped away from Charles's army, heading back toward Augsburg and alternative employment. The very next year, Charles met his end outside the city of Nancy, his head split open by a Swiss halberd and his army utterly destroyed. Hans had left just in time. As long as the Duke's money had held out, Hans had been a loyal enough soldier, but there was no room for sentiment in the mercenaries' line of work. He thought about going to Hungary to work for its king, Matthias Corvinus, in his professional army. Italy might have been an option with its standing mercenary forces of condottieri, but gunners weren't in great demand without regular campaigns. He didn't much fancy fighting for the Venetians against the Ottomans in some Balkan hellhole of a fortress either. In the end, Hans stuck around Germany, finding work here and there in still more small wars and feuds. Business picked back up again in 1479. With Charles the Bold dead, the Burgundian lands mostly passed to his daughter, Mary, and her new husband, Maximilian. Maximilian was a member of the Habsburg dynasty, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III. But the King of France, Louis XI, known as the Universal Spider for his devious plotting, wanted the whole of what had once belonged to Charles the Bold. He had already taken the Duchy of Burgundy, which was part of the French crown, but he also wanted Picardy in northern France, Flanders, and anything else beyond that he could grab. Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy didn't intend to let that happen, and war was the result. Hans was hired to fight in Maximilian's army and made his first trip to Flanders, then to northern France, where he fought in a large battle in 1479. War was changing. It wasn't just the gunpowder weaponry in which Hans had become an expert over the past few years. It was also pikes, long spears, wielded by the disciplined Swiss who had put Charles the Bold's mercenaries to flight time after time, Hans included. Assembled into thick square formations, blocks bristling with sharp spear points, the Swiss could defend themselves against the most devastating charge of armored, mounted men-at-arms. When they moved forward, they were a steamrolling hedgehog with enough mass and weight to slam through any line of enemy infantry. They were militia rather than professionals, called up for a few weeks or months at a time, but their way of fighting had proven itself in the fires of the Burgundian Wars. Charles had spent every ducat in his treasury on fancy professionals imported from across the continent, and a bunch of Swiss part-timers had stomped them into the ground. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Flemish pikemen in Maximilian's army had stopped French men-at-arms at that battle in 1479, and the South Germans took notice of what their Swiss neighbors were doing as well. By the early 1480s, they had picked up the pike and pike formations, often serving in mercenary units with Swiss who had left home to find work. One such group found its way to southern Spain to fight in Isabella and Ferdinand's war against the Moors of Granada. Hans went with them. Gunners and arquebusiers were in high demand, not just pikemen, and plenty of German, English, and French technical specialists, like Hans, made their way south. A couple of years of good wages and constant work in the slow process of besieging fortresses in the mountains of southern Spain gave Hans a great deal of experience and expertise. Hans returned back north to Germany in 1485. He ran into his old acquaintance, Martin Schwarz, now notorious as a mercenary commander, and joined up with him. They were taking the coin of Maximilian, heir apparent as Holy Roman Emperor and effective ruler of the Burgundian Netherlands on behalf of his young son Philip. The Low Countries were always restive and rebellious. Its towns and cities had strong ideas about their independence and their rights, beliefs that clashed with Maximilian's need for tax reform and desire for direct control. Open rebellion broke out in 1485. Maximilian hired Martin Schwarz and a bunch of pike and handgun-wielding Swiss and German mercenaries, Hans among them, to deal with the rebels. They did so with skill and cruelty. Schwarz had always had a nasty reputation, and it had only grown in the years since he and Hans had left Augsburg. When Schwarz retook the towns of Alst and Nineveh, about halfway between Ghent and Brussels, he let his men pillage and destroy. Hans and his comrades stole everything that wasn't nailed down, burned homes and businesses, and committed acts of terrible violence. The blood of civilians ran through the streets, smoke reached to the sky, and the mercenaries went on their way. Hans was no longer the young, impressionable shoemaker's son who had left Augsburg so many years before. His squashed nose and cauliflower ear marked a face that had seen a lifetime of violence. Burns from servicing hot cannon and arquebuses marred his hands and arms. An explosion had taken the tip of a finger on his right hand. A beard covered most of his face, but there was a knife scar visible underneath, running along the line of his jaw. A patch of burnt-over skin marked the right side of his face, near where the burning slow match of an arquebus ignited the gunpowder when it fired, throwing up sparks that seared his cheek again and again. This was not a kind face, particularly when framed beneath the T-shaped opening of his Italian steel helmet. He had been a victim and perpetrator of terrible acts, and there was little about war that bothered him these days. The conduct of Hans and his leader, Martin Schwarz, certainly troubled some folks in the Low Countries, including Maximilian himself. Another who disliked their savagery, if not their undeniable effectiveness, was Margaret, the Dowager Duchess of Burgundy. She was the widow of Charles the Bold and an active participant not just in the politics of the Low Countries, but also the world beyond. Margaret, you see, had been born Margaret of York, daughter of old Duke Richard of York, and sister of King Edward IV of England. She retained her interest in England even after her brother Edward's untimely death in 1483, her brother Richard's usurpation, and then Richard's death in 1485 at the hands of Henry Tudor. Margaret had designs on returning her family to the English throne, and a tool, or rather a few of them, soon presented themselves.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
It's common to refer to the Wars of the Roses and the bouts of strife that consumed France, Aragon, and Castile at the same time as civil wars. Now, to some extent, this is true, but it's also an oversimplification. What they really were, dynastic conflicts. And dynasties weren't confined to a single kingdom. Their members married broadly, forged alliances, and built loyalties with key figures on an international scale. When Edward IV was exiled from England during his reign, for example, he went to his brother-in-law Charles the Bold for aid. Louis XI intervened in the Aragonese Civil War. The War of Castilian Succession involved the King of Portugal. Henry Tudor invaded England in 1485 with an army of French mercenaries. These are just a few examples. All of these civil wars were part of a broader pattern of dynastic instability and upheaval that spanned most of Western Europe during the later 15th century. Margaret of York's hatred of Henry Tudor and willingness to invest her resources in trying to unseat him was just a manifestation of this trend. The tools Margaret found for the task didn't offer much hope, but then again, Henry Tudor had looked like a lost cause too. One key piece of the plan was an imposter claiming to be Edward, Earl of Warwick, a boy named Lambert Simnel. Lambert Simnel's real identity wasn't important. He looked like a royal youth, a potential claimant to the English throne, and he could easily be replaced with the real thing or with someone else when the time came. The point was his value as a public relations tool. Far more important to the cause was John de la Pole, the Earl of Lincoln, formerly a key ally of the usurping King Richard III. The Earl of Lincoln, 27 years old in 1487, had also been Richard's designated heir. That wasn't much of a claim to the throne, but it was every bit as good as Henry Tudor's had been, especially if he could find a nice dynastic marriage to cement his position. The key player, of course, was Margaret of York, the Dowager Duchess of Burgundy, who had money to burn and serious connections. One of those connections was with Maximilian and his hired German mercenaries. Martin Schwarz and men like Hans might have been distasteful, vicious, and disliked by the populace of the Low Countries, but they were cutting-edge professionals. More important, their services were available. Maximilian breathed a sigh of relief to be rid of them and the problems they caused with his subjects in Flanders. That was how, in May of 1487, Hans found himself on a ship bound not for England, but for Ireland, where the conspiracy against Henry Tudor had found allies among the Irish nobility. The unlikely Lambert Simnel was crowned King Edward VI in Dublin Cathedral, and the Earl of Lincoln found a cadre of some 4,000 Irish mercenaries to join his professional Swiss and Germans under Martin Schwarz. When they arrived in England, Lincoln assumed, the country would rise up in rebellion against Henry Tudor, and their forces would swell further. At least, that was the plan as Martin Schwarz and presumably Hans understood it. The invading army arrived in northern England on June 4, 1487. The Swiss and Germans were able to speak to one another, but not to the Irish, and they had to use translators to communicate with the Earl of Lincoln and their paltry few English supporters. Over the next week, they quickly marched south, but the presumed English allies never really showed up. Martin Schwarz sensed that things weren't going well, and so did Hans. Schwarz confronted Lincoln, accusing him of self-deception, but nonetheless promised to fulfill the promises he'd made to Margaret of Burgundy. There was nowhere else to go anyway. They could fight and win, or die. Meanwhile, Henry VII, Henry Tudor, was assembling his own army. He knew he'd have to fight for his throne, and he did not intend to be taken down, as he himself had defeated Richard III. Henry was always patient, and he waited until he assembled all his forces before going after Lincoln, Schwarz, and our friend Hans. June 16, 1487, dawned bright and clear on the rebel camp outside the village of East Stoke, Nottinghamshire. Hans ate a little bit of bread and cheese, but avoided the masses that priests were saying throughout the camp. He preferred to check the powder charges for his arquebus and sharpen his short sword and dagger once more. He pulled on his breastplate and jammed his Italian-made helmet onto his head. A length of slow match went between his teeth while he prepared the firing mechanism of his arquebus, and he lit it from the burning embers of his campfire. Small skeins of smoke rose from the sparking match, which he placed in the serpentine mechanism of the arquebus. He loaded the firearm carefully, then joined his fellow mercenaries. They chatted away in German and hefted pikes, halberds, and arquebuses. The foreigners stared at the half-naked Irish with their throwing darts and daggers and small round shields, and looked at the English bowmen and a very few men-at-arms in their suits of plate armor. None of this inspired much confidence in Hans. He'd been in winning armies and losing ones, and this one felt like a loser. But he'd taken his money, he was a professional, and all he could do was fight and try to survive. The rebel army drew up at the top of a ridge, looking down across an open field toward the River Trent below. The Swiss and Germans were formed up in a hedgehog block bristling with pikes and wicked halberds, axes mounted on long poles, with the handgunners like Hans on the flanks. Then there were the Irish next to them in a loose formation, and finally the English, most of them of poor quality, or so it seemed to Hans. They waited for what felt like hours. Cold sweat began to pool under their helmets and armor. Their weapons grew heavy in their arms. Hans cut another length of match, lit it, and jammed it into his arquebus's firing mechanism. Finally, the enemy appeared in the field below them, thousands of them. Hans saw bowmen, infantry with pole arms, bills, he'd heard the English call them, and then the clanking men-at-arms in suits of plate with their great swords, short lances, and wicked pole axes. Hans glanced over at Martin Schwarz, mounted on a nag of a horse next to the Earl of Lincoln, and saw him gesturing. They had to attack now, Schwarz was saying, before the rest of the English forces could come up, before their longbowmen had the chance to pepper them with volley after volley of arrows. This was just the vanguard of the Royal Army, not the whole body. But if they could break them first, then maybe they could win the whole battle before they were overwhelmed. There was no choice. Lincoln signaled and Schwarz bawled orders in German. The pikemen leveled their pikes and started moving forward, disciplined in formation. The Irish weren't as organized and started jogging through the field, outpacing their comrades. Down below, Hans saw the vanguard of the Royal Army halt and form up. The bowmen fitted arrows to their longbows, drew, and held. A shower of arrows would soon follow. Hans heard them before he saw them fly through the air, a kind of keening whistle. He'd heard it before in Charles the Bold's army, but he'd never been on the receiving end of English archers. He felt it now. The shafts tore through the Irish to his side. Screams erupted, dozens, then hundreds. Fewer landed among the Swiss and Germans, at least for now. Another shower followed just a few seconds later, then another, then another. The Irish ranks thinned, and a few pikemen started to fall. He was close enough now. Hans leveled his arquebus and picked a target, a man-at-arms in full armor, and pulled the trigger. Fire and smoke belched outward, obscuring his vision. His comrades followed suit, and soon a white cloud enveloped their line. Cannon boomed, adding their roar to the crackle of arquebuses, the whine of arrows, the clang of metal arrowheads on armor, the thud of impact into flesh, and above it all, the screams. Hans reloaded and fired again, then again, before the Swiss and Germans impacted the English formation with all the force of a crashing cart. Through the smoke, he saw the Irish whipping their darts toward the enemy, glimpsed billmen and longbowmen falling, the royalist men-at-arms cleaving through their foes with swords and pole arms. The crash of impact rolled back and forth, the lines separating for a few minutes, then slamming back together. All the while, Hans kept firing, and so did the archers, their arrows whistling and tearing through the rebel ranks. On and on this went. Slowly, the rebel ranks thinned. More and more pikemen and Irish fell, crushed by the weight of English numbers. Hans felt the mercenaries crack, felt the panic start to rise. He knew it would soon be time to go. There was a thin gully running down toward the river, away from the battle, maybe an old cattle trackway or a sunken lane. That's where he would go when the time came, Hans thought. All at once, it seemed, the rebel lines broke. The Irish turned and ran, unencumbered by armor or heavy weapons. The rebel English turned tail. The Swiss and German mercenaries, Hans included, were almost surrounded. He saw Schwarz go down a few paces away, pulled from his horse by a billman, and stabbed to death with daggers on the ground. Now was the time. Hans felt the escape route closing. Suddenly, there was an English man-at-arms in front of him, a poleaxe swinging through the air. It was all he could do to get his arquebus up to deflect the blow. He'd had enough. He dropped the handgun and turned to run. He barely made it through with a few dozen others before the cordon closed, cutting off any chance of escape for the remaining mercenaries. Hans made for that gully, where hundreds of Irish, English, Germans, and Swiss were likewise fleeing. The royalists were hot on their tail. He ran until his lungs burned, saw men cut down by well-aimed arrows, sword and dagger thrusts, and the blows of pole arms. An awful pain erupted in his arm where an arrow sliced through his flesh, but he still didn't stop. Anybody who stopped was dead. Finally, Hans made it to the river. He chanced a glimpse behind him and wished he hadn't. The gully ran red with blood. Locals called it the Red Gutter for generations afterward. The screaming injured and motionless dead were everywhere on the hillside, leading back toward the battlefield, and only a few others, Irish, Germans, and a couple of English, had made it down to the water. There was a spot shallow enough to cross, and Hans splashed into the ice-cold water. He spotted a stand of woods ahead, oak, and made for what might be safety. And that is how Hans ended up in Nottinghamshire, running for his life, his lungs burning, blood pouring from his arm, looking for a place to hide. The currents of dynastic politics had pulled him there. So had developments in military technology and the growth of an international market in mercenaries. The enmities of Margaret of York and the ambitions of the Earl of Lincoln, the marriage of Maximilian to Mary of Burgundy, and the unlikely success of Henry Tudor had all played their role in bringing about this final battle of the Wars of the Roses. None of this crossed Hans's mind as he hid under the felled oak. He scrunched down still further and felt the footsteps and voices approaching. "Let them pass, God," he prayed. "Let me make it back home to Augsburg one more time." Looking out from his hiding spot, he caught a glimpse of torn cloth, soaked with his blood, lying on the ground where he'd left it after mopping up the gash on his arm. He saw a hand reach down and pick it up, then a foot clad in a leather boot pointing toward his hiding spot. The voices stopped. The footsteps came closer and closer. Metal clanked on metal. Then the telltale whisper of a steel blade emerging from a scabbard, almost silent. That was the last sound Hans ever heard. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be shifting our focus to one of the great conflicts of the 16th century, the clash between the Ottomans, led by their great Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, and the Habsburg dynasty of Spain and the Holy Roman Empire. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.